I taught at Berkeley and again at San Jose State. The idea was that if you miss a class and you want to come in to the office, you've got my name card, you can come in and listen to it. Or if you got a tape recorder at home, you can come and bring a blank in and we can dub it for you. Never worked very well at Berkeley, and nobody ever came in to listen to it or not. But I use it for my own purposes. Anyway, it's there, available, if you need it. At this first meeting, I'd like to do four things. First, explain what this course is all about, the ground rules, if you will, what you can expect from me, and what I will expect from you. So it involves, to a certain degree, sort of ruminations on teaching. Second, I'd like to give you an opportunity to help shape the curriculum, at least to the extent of getting suggestions from you as to what the content of my lectures should be. Try to do this at the end of the session. Third, I'd like to tell you a bit about myself. Political science autobiography is a form of taxidermy, as we used to say in the political science field. I'll scatter this sort of throughout the lecture. Also in the reader, there is my CV. Finally, I'd like to offer you a bit of gratuitous advice on college life. This is the first class zero. It's an organizing class, and it doesn't really count, I think, in the grand scheme of things, and it probably won't last the whole hour and a half. You should have before you five items. Syllabus, number the 3330 paper. The main point of that is that university rules prevail here. Whatever the university says is supposed to be, since I'm brand new to this here, since I plan to follow the rules. Second thing is the class schedule, the list of the lectures. The third is the class profile form in two parts, which I think most of you have and perhaps are filling out now. You can fill these out if you want before we leave and give them back to me. These are what the name says. It's a class profile. I try to get an idea of who you people are, where you're coming from, and what kind of a background you have. It's not a test. The fifth item is an op-ed piece from the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is the Bible of the academic world, an op-ed article on lecturing. I'll come back to something about that. And the final item to note is the textbook. Whoops. Which I think some of you have already purchased. It's the people over at the copy. What is it? Copy. I have it here. Copy Tech in West Hall. Is in room 162, and they have a set of a supply of these. I think they sell for about 16. Anybody bought one yet? It's funny, they said they sold three or four. Must be my competition in other classes teaching the Vietnam War. Anyway, you can pick one up there. It is a collection of my writings over the years, mostly for books that I've done or chapters of books or conference books. We have a lecture later on bibliography of materials of the field. Suffice to say here, there is, in my mind, no adequate textbook on the Vietnam War. The only one that sort of would come within range of this is a book called International History of the Vietnam War by R.B. Smith, who was in the school in London. And he's an old-time Brit historian and one of the very best. Unfortunately, this book is in five volumes, and he's only up to volume four now. I don't know if they have it in the library, but it's the one book on the Vietnam War that is really solid. I mean, it deals with all of the subjects up to date and in a very objective way. I asked him once if he was going to boil this down into a single, you know, it's going to be 1,500, maybe 2,000 pages, probably sell for about $350 for the whole set. I said, are you planning to boil this down into a single text? And he said, hell no. You think I could have written it in one book? I'd have written five books. So it's a serious series in any case. But the problem of the rest of the just one more comment on bibliography. There are a lot of good books on fairly narrow subjects of the Vietnam War. This is what I call the tunnels of Cu Chi syndrome. The Viet Cong had tunnels outside of Saigon, and a couple of journalists did a book on this with good photographs and very good description. And if you suffer from claustrophobia, it makes you sweat just reading it. So it tells you more about the tunnels of Cu Chi than you care to know. There are a whole series of books that do that, very narrow subjects, but none that sort of cover the whole waterfront. There are good military history texts and a few good political settlement type or off the battlefield histories, but nothing really, in my opinion, that combines these. That's why I put together this series of lectures and readings and so on key topics within the war, and you should use that more as a reference work than the kind of textbook that you just sit down and read through. All right, moving on to item two, content. Let me say a bit about my philosophy of education. I'm not a teacher. I've done quite a bit of teaching. I was at Cal for 15 years. I taught journalism in Tokyo part-time to some military journalists from the Army Specialized Education Program. Taught at Saigon University to a special group of South Vietnamese government officials on Marxism and Leninism, which they knew nothing about, even though they were fighting the Marxists and Leninists. And I've taught in Washington and in Baltimore in what's called the Great Books Program, which are the great books of the Western world. So I've done a lot of teaching, but I do not think of myself as a teacher, and I do not think of myself as an academic, although I have written a great deal of academic materials. I think what I am basically, I think of myself at least as a writer. And I've, the 22 years I was in the State Department, the journalistic jobs I had before that at the Washington Star, for example, and radio news shows, radio operations in Tokyo and in Hong Kong, in all of these, what I really did was write. And I think of myself as a writer, and I think that I'm a person who has spent his life putting down words on a piece of paper one after the other. As an old editor I once worked for said, I've written a million words about nothing, and by God, I can do it again. seven books, I think, and 20 chapter books, and probably 1,200 articles, periodical pieces, and so on. So I am not a I'm not an educator in any sense. I've never been trained in this. Have done a lot of lecturing on Vietnam. That was part of the job in the State Department, most of it, actually. I probably made something like 2,000 lectures in 40 countries around the world. These are on State Department trips, mostly during the war and mostly explaining. Yeah.
Which administration
were you in? Most of them, beginning with Lincoln. No, I went to Vietnam in 1960. Before that, I had been in government working for the Voice of America, covering the White House in the Eisenhower years. That was my first experience with the president. And then I've been working on, after beginning 1960 until up to the present time, I've been devoted one way or another on the subject of Vietnam. I think of myself as the last survivor here on the wall at Fort Necessity. Anyway, I'm a square peg. I don't think people in the Foreign Service ever considered me to be a diplomat either. They never knew ambassadors I worked for, never knew quite what to make of me, except I was useful to them. I could write them speeches that had a lot of jokes in them, and they appreciated that. Very few people in the Foreign Service have a sense of humor, I discovered. I did my master's thesis on humor, incidentally. I'm an expert on humor, among other things. The thesis is not funny, though. It's a serious subject. Humor is one of the unresolved philosophic questions. We don't know what is funny and what isn't, really. There's several theories on this, but none of them cover the whole range. Anyway, teaching, in my opinion, is, I think, quite obviously, if it's properly done, is a communicational transaction. As well, writers do, of course, they are engaged in communicational transaction, action across, action to the target and an action and a response back. Teaching is not properly a one-directional activity. It is not, as the classic one-liner has it, education is a process whereby the information passes from the lecture card of the professor to the notebook of the student without going through the mind of either. I am a very strong believer in the Socratic dialogue teaching method. Any familiar with this concept? We used it in the great books. This is essentially teaching by asking questions. And essentially, it means teaching to think. In this case, I would suppose it would be thinking about the war. So it's very lugubrious, very time-consuming, and it cannot be done much more than a one-on-one basis. You can't do it in a class this size. A famous example of this is Plato's account of Socrates and the slave boy, in which he demonstrates the Socratic dialogue technique by teaching this boy, who is an illiterate, totally uneducated young man, the Pythagorean theorem of geometry. You know, who knows what the Pythagorean theorem is? Square of the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares of the other two sides. And he does this by drawing out, by just asking this kid questions. And he didn't even know, I'm sure he didn't know he probably knew what a triangle was, right angle triangle, but that's about all. But the end of this session, it's not clear how long it went on, the boy suddenly says, "Ah, I see. The square of the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the square of the other two sides." He taught him something about geometry, but he also taught him how to think. Well, we're not going to use that method here, although I may at times try to fall back on it. So the basic rule in Socratic dialogue, you cannot make a flat dogmatic statement. Everything you say to the student has to be a question. Of course, it can be a fairly long speech, and at the end of which you say, "Isn't that so?" But nevertheless, you're not pumping out information. You're just asking questions of the student. It's quite fascinating if you ever get involved in this. I think they did. There are a couple. There's a school in Baltimore that used this. Taught the whole 4 years undergraduate work using the Socratic dialogue technique. We had no, when we lived in Washington, luck at all trying to talk our three children into going to this school. I think it scared them. Anyway, there is a basic difference, in my opinion, between academics and scholars, particularly as a writer, looking at academics as writers and scholars as writers. They write in different styles, quite obviously. Both can write in a turgid, overqualified manner, but generally the academics do this more than do the scholars. That is, write in a more dense, dull fashion. Academic writing often is pompous. Scholarly writing seldom is. Academic writing is devoid of any true significance, or it, at best it is so narrow that it is virtually without significance, while scholarly writing is worth reading if it interests you. Academic writing is not, although you may have to read it if you're in college. Scholarly writing sells well in the literary marketplace outside. Academic writing, basically unknown there. Some academic texts sell for the hundreds of thousands, as you may know, because they are required reading. But they're unknown and without influence outside of the classroom. The academics, I think, like it this way. They do not have, as scholars do, a passion for getting people told. That's one of my favorite concepts. I got it from William Faulkner once while chaperoning him around Tokyo. I'll come back to this. You'll probably hear me say this a number of times, this passion for getting people told. It's what drives every good writer. You can say of an academic that he or she knows everything but understands nothing. But you cannot say this of a scholar. In teaching today, there's a great debate, one more point on rumination on teaching. There's a great debate in the academy currently, although there always seems to be a great debate going on somewhere in the academy. It's probably very important to those of you who plan to teach. We are entering a new millennium, which we are told will radically alter the way teaching is done. Technology is going to change it all, especially the lecture, which has become the medium since the Middle Ages in the West, and for 1,000 years before that in China. To date, these predictions of progress and change and the end of the lecture is kind of a false start. Perhaps not. It will happen eventually. So the question, really, a philosophic question, is the lecture doomed as a mechanism in the classroom? For the moment, I remain dedicated to the lecture. I admit it can be a crutch, but in any case, if you want to read my defense, want to understand my defense, read that handout there from the International Chronology. I remember when I was an undergraduate, I took a sociology course and a social problems course. And I cornered the professor on the way out one day and said, I was in the barber chair yesterday and I read this article in Reader's Digest about the future of sociology and what it's going to become. I said, and it had these several, I don't even remember what it was now, but I said, it made several basic points, so and so and so and so. And I said, are you familiar with this? And he said, yes, I am. And I said, what do you think of it? He said, I think it's totally wrong, because if it is not totally wrong, I'm going to have to rewrite all of my lecture notes. That's the crutch, of course, with the problem with the lecture. Okay. A little comment on college life. Yes, this is probably for those of you who have not been in college very long. But it's probably good advice in any case. There were supposed to be two freshmen in here, but I was told, but in this chart they gave me, they're not, nobody, you're all listed as a, let me just check, what is your name? Yeah, you're right, it is, you are listed as a freshman. So maybe I'm directing this mostly to you. Rules for getting along, or rules to remember while you're in college. One, ask questions. Leave no reasonable question unanswered. Two, make friends with your peers, those who have the same philosophic interests as you do, who share the same intellectual curiosities, who are headed in the same general career direction that you are. Three, before you leave college, try to settle on something meaningful to do with your life. You may come to college with this already decided, particularly if you are a religious person, or you may believe, as I do, I'm an agnostic, I guess you would say, that life has no ultimate meaning, that we live beneath the senseless stars and write our meanings in them, as Thomas Wolfe, the first Thomas Wolfe, wrote in You Can't Go Home Again. Or maybe look homeward, Angel. In any case, what is important is to find something that you feel deeply is worth doing, something to throw your life away on, as I did, I suppose, with Vietnam. Although I like to think I threw it away on becoming a writer. Finally, four, have fun. I'm not advocating hedonism, Omar Khayyam and a loaf of bread and jug of roast and a jug of wine and thou in the wilderness, the lion women in song. I'm not advocating that necessarily. But take pleasure in your educational experience. There are many kinds of fun, intellectual fun for one, and not only beer bust. This bothered me at the University of California. The students seemed so serious, so humorless, so hag-ridden by worry and anxiety that they weren't having any fun. And that wasn't the way when I was an undergraduate. I was at Cal as an undergraduate. It was a completely different world. But whatever it is that turns you on, have fun. All right, now I would like to ask you, if you are so moved, to tell me what you think I should teach you. What is it you would like to get out of this course? Those last two handouts, or the class profile, that I'll when you give those back to me, I'll go over them very carefully. It will give me a profile of you people, what your background is, and I can learn quite a bit from going through this, so that's the main input here. But if there are other, if you have any special interests, anything that you really, particularly if you look at the list of lectures, is there anything on there that you don't see and you think ought to be there? Yeah.
I'd in particular be more interested to know about the U.S. back and the French, French struggle.
All right. Well, that comes early, and I'll make a note of this. The French era in general, and the Viet Minh War, I suppose, in our involvement in it, or lack of it, or degree of it. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
I'm sure you'll be covering the biography of Ho Chi Minh.
Yeah, there's one lecture on, in fact, I think it's two or one, it's on called Personalities. And the first part of that is a kind of brief biographical sketches of the principals in Vietnam on both sides. And the second one is, the second hour of that is probably more of that, but it also tries to focus down on the concept of leadership. I mean, not just individuals, who they are, their biographies, but their qualities of leadership, their weaknesses, and so on. It's a tough subject to handle, but It is as important as anything that you can deal with, I think, in Vietnam. Leadership is, if you work in government, as I did, and my last job in government was working for Henry Kissinger in a State Department Policy Planning Council, and we were sort of in-house experts on various subjects, were advising him on whatever we were an expert on. My field, of course, was Indochina. I went there right after the war in 75, and I think I was a kind of painful presence for Henry. I often thought he'd duck into the women's room if he saw me coming down the hall, because I was a ghost Christmas past. But he would, I'd come in with problems and things that he should know about. This was our job, is to keep him appraised. Are the Vietnamese selling their captured arms around the world or not? What about these rifles that show up in Nicaragua with serial numbers we trace back to Vietnam and that sort of thing? Anyway, you get a very... I had been a field person. I spent my whole career in the Foreign Service in the field. And so I had the usual thoughts about the leadership, the principles, as we called them in Washington. Kind of a contemptuous attitude which field people have toward people at the center. And it wasn't until I got back at the center and sort of looking over the shoulder of these principals that I sort of came to understand their problems. I had the notion that if the Secretary of State wanted, or the President wanted something done, he just picked up a phone and it was done. And you learn that it's not true in Washington. They also say it's not true in Moscow, and it's certainly not true in Vietnam today. But anyway, he gave me a different view of leadership, and it's a hard thing to deal with, but it's, goes back to this God give us men poetry that today in Washington was the absence, in my opinion, almost total absence of leadership anywhere, really, in the White House, the State Department, the Pentagon. I go back to Washington today, I'm hesitant to look up my old friends because it's very embarrassing to talk to them about policy. Just, what are you people think you're doing? And this is a guy you've known for years, and he knows that you know that he knows that the whole thing is a hopeless mess at the time. But we used to always feel that way. So the problem is that it's very easy to say, well, we need a strong leadership, and that is not the answer. This second lecture will deal with what I think is the basic elements of leadership within the Vietnam War and the failures, evaluation some of the generals on both sides. Anything else that any of you? Yeah. The aftermath of the war.
Yeah, I could see that.
The spitting on their medals and that sort of thing.
Well, just like, during the other parts of the war, the end of war, things changed, and
it's
like,
looking back to. Right. Yeah, public opinion attitudes did change. One of the problems in dealing with the history of the Vietnam War is that nothing you can say about it is wholly true because of the duration of the war. It went on for such a long time that almost everything changed. Our rationale for being there, the public's opinion of the war, expectations of how the war is going to turn out. You can trace this historically through the whole, depending on when you want to start I usually say it began in 1959 for our purposes, but there was obviously a prelude before it, and there is an aftermath. That's also one of the problems I think I have in teaching this. Most history courses on the Vietnam War will begin in 1965, when the Americans' troops landed in force, and will end in 72, or a little before, when the Americans got out. And that's it. And there's very little before or after. And if you had been in Vietnam, as I had, through the whole bloody thing, you do have, among other things, a kind of sense of perception, a perspective, that what went on before the war has enormous meaning to the history of the war, and what happened in the history of the war had great meaning as to what happened today, right down to the present moment when Boris Yeltsin is going to Hanoi, for God knows why. But it's understandable, reasonable, if you have a kind of appreciation of this great river of events. You also have, there is another great debate in history, which has to do with the role of the individual in making history as opposed to social forces making history. Now, the Marxists believe, of course, that all history is history of the class conflict and history of the... They do not believe that individuals count for much. I knew at a conference in Moscow in which one intellectual Russian, in answer to my question, I said, "You're telling me the Russian Revolution would have gone the same way had Lenin never been born." He said, "Yes, it would. Somebody else would have taken. Lenin himself wasn't important. It was these great forces at work." Now, that's an extremist, determinist attitude toward, and I don't think anybody, hardly anywhere, I'm told you got a few history teachers here who still believe this, but I don't think anybody hardly believes that anymore. At the other end of is that the individual is what counts for everything. And in early histories, 500,000 years ago, yeah, that was basically true. What the emperor said we're going to do, we did, and that was the history that was made. I'm not sure it was all that true even then, but this concept of the individual as being the shaper of history went right down to modern times. Woodrow Wilson, who wrote a lot of history, made this famous observation that history is but the lengthened shadow of great men. I suppose today we'd say in great women. But his belief that all of this was done by individuals. Well, those are the sort of extreme positions, and I don't think anybody really buys into them. The truth is somewhere in between. It's very hard to fix, and it seems to keep changing. And I think it's a dilemma oftentimes in trying to understand actually the other aspect of this is those who believe that, the determinists believe that that they believe the dialectical materialism, the idea that everything has a cause, everything is explainable, there are laws of history, basic Marxism, and then there are those who do not see history that mechanistic. And there's a lot of arguments against it, in my opinion. I see history as a great river of events, and we're all afloat on it, and there's eddies and tides and whirlpools and so on, and you can navigate this, or a society can navigate it to a certain degree, but nobody can control the direction of the river. It seems to me that's self-evident. But it's one of those great debates you find among academic historians. It's one can't ever really be resolved. It's simply like these other philosophic arguments. In the end, you have to decide for yourself. Like a Monday after Monday evening beer commercials, you make the call. Yes?
I'm interested, maybe you can explain more just today, and I know you interjected later on, but like what your experiences were, because we can read history books, but I'm interested in, a lot of reason I took the class, because you're supposedly one of the experts in the country.
Well, that's terribly seductive, you know. The first time I caught this, I got seduced again and again by stories, you know. And I could tell they were interested in them, and you know. But a lot of them were sort of pointless. They were just, you know, one line shy. So I've been trying to, over the years, to winnow this down. I will do a lot of that, and a lot of personal. But the point is, an anecdote has to have a point to it. And it's a fine way of teaching history if the anecdote really has a message in it. And it's interesting, and it's a thing that sticks in your mind. My memory of going to schools, I think most of what I knew and know, when I think back about it, it is the stories and the anecdotes that the professor told, which made a historical point that sticks in my mind. That's why I remember it. And the total abstractions of just a theoretical construct, it just doesn't stick. You don't think it sticks. Maybe it does, but there's nothing like a telling anecdote to really drive home a moral. But I've got to watch myself that I don't start. It's all the old Vietnam types are this way. You get them going and they'll go on and on. I remember the time at Sok Chong. Yeah.
Did we learn a little bit more about black ops that aren't necessarily like your standard Vietnam curriculum, such as incursions into Cambodia and Laos?
Yeah, I have one lecture which really deals with the spooks and and intelligence, counterintelligence. It's a very muddy, murky, muzzy world, you understand. I mean, these guys are professionals in disinformation and hiding things and misleading you and themselves oftentimes. So it's a historian's nightmare to try to go back and sort this out. Partly even the people who are involved in this, trying to do this, if they're not all the way to the top, and maybe if they even are all the way to the top, they don't know the whole truth themselves. At the Association of Asian Studies annual meeting in Washington last spring, I was on a panel with three CIA people reading papers about the CIA and the Zim Coups, CIA and I forgot two other black operations or covert operations, and I was supposed to comment on them. And these guys are all still working for CIA, and the CIA is very much aware of their problem of public relations. And so they are encouraging this sort of thing. And I was very much interested in encouraging the CIA and getting their people to write, to publish, to declassify, Dynamic, what it is. Just give it to us, give it to academics, and we'll work with it. But it's the first time I'd really thought seriously about this subject. Here's an example of my getting off the track. By years with the... As in government, I was what was known as a consumer of intelligence. And I had total clearance, code word clearance, and so on. And these guys would come in and brief us, either in Washington or back in Vietnam. And we never really trusted them. And we were never sure that we could believe them. And mostly, we didn't know if they really knew what they were talking about. You know, they say, well, we have this classified information that proves so-and-so. And you say, well, I can't tell you the sources, but you have to take my word for it. And half the time, it turned out to be totally wrong. And it's a major problem for the principals. Kissinger used to say, I don't think this fellow that just briefed me knows what he's talking about, but I'm going to have to go with what he told me, because I don't have anything else to go with. The Brits used to, and there's a new biography of Churchill, and he had that same problem. His long passages of it, he's complaining about how he doesn't believe the intelligence people, but he has to believe them. You've got to get into the mind of the spook. They live in a completely different world. I'll try to pull my thoughts together on this a little more carefully when I get to that lecture. Yeah.
The military, from my experience, a lot of people in the military seem to believe in this sort of stolen victory theory. That is that, we could have won in Vietnam were we able to thoroughly bomb the Ho Chi Minh Trail and
That's Joe Alsop's column said we snatched defeat out of the mouth of victory. And he died believing that. And he was one of the best observers, as journalists go. Yeah, it's still being widely debated. A lot of the military, the generals, have written rather dogmatic assertions, in my opinion, that we definitely could have won. I don't think they know enough about the enemy, to come to that kind of a judgment. And that is my field, basically. My basic field is the other side in Vietnam. At least it started out to be. When I arrived in Vietnam in 1960, the Viet Cong National Liberation Front was just being formed. I came in and I began to follow them for a very narrow academic reason. It was to understand how they communicate ideas. What's the mechanism the National Liberation Front uses? I knew they had a radio liberation and so on, but that was not aimed at the guy out in the Rice Paddy. That was what we call an esoteric form of communication. It was aimed at cadres and leaders throughout the South and in the NLF camp. What they did use was social organization as channels of communication. And that is what, in my master's degree work, this is what I was interested in, is the communication of ideas in societies where you do not have mass communication, where you have word of mouth, which is the standard way that ideas have been communicated through most of man's history. One person tells another, an itinerant peddler comes through the village, that's the way information was. Second is mass media, radio, television, newspaper. The third is social organizations as channels of communication. That is the second most important and most long-standing form of communication of ideas. And so what I wanted to do was to look at how the National Liberation Front, as a medium of communication, was communicating its ideas. What were these ideas, and what was the mechanism by which they communicated them? And I got a sabbatical from state in 1963 to go back to do a book on this subject. This is one of these competitive things where you get out of the country by putting in a proposal, and they give you the money, and you go to any school that you want. It's a nice deal. So I proposed. Vietnam was just becoming very hot at the time, so I had to kind of leg up. So I picked MIT because Dan Lerner, one of the great figures of all times on communication of ideas, had come through Saigon, and I was terribly impressed by him. I was, very young in those days. So I wound up at MIT to do this book on the communication process of the National Liberation Front. And that's what they gave me the money to do. When I got there, Max Millikan and the others say, write it on the Viet Cong or the NLF. Don't write it on this communication of ideas. And I said, well, but Washington doesn't care. And that's true. At the end of the thing, American wrote a very nice letter to the department, and they were very happy, and they couldn't, I realized, they couldn't care less what I'd been doing out there. They send out 8 or 10 of these every year, so it's not all that important. Anyway, Lucien Pai, who was my advisor, and one of the great figure is China specialist. Anything you ever read by Lucien Pai is very good. He's sort of retired now, but he was born in China as the son of a missionary, and so he thinks like a Chinese, I think. Raised on a big red-headed Irishman, but he said, well, yes, the problem is, this is sort of Chinese thinking too, you're supposed to write this on communication. I said, right. Okay, you define what the Viet Cong do. Everything they do is an act of communication. If they ambush an Arvin company, that's they're delivering a message, aren't they? I said, yeah. So, okay, you say everything that they're doing is an act of communication, and that meets the technical definition. I'm really worried about this at the time, you know, because I was so green that I realized I got the end of the year. Manovich tries, I was going to get a doctorate. That was the point. That's why I was there, really. And this was going to be my dissertation. And there was then Millikan, you don't need a dissertation. They're nothing but a union card for if you're going to teach. But by the time you finish out there in Vietnam, you can come back here and teach. I'll guarantee you, you get a job. We've got people here. Harold Isaacs, one of the great early reporters, was a full professor there. Didn't even have a high school degree. So you don't need this, you know. Same reason here. I got here. I don't have a doctorate, but it doesn't seem to bother anybody. Anyway, I don't know, just to complete this seductive aside, I got a phone call from the State Department saying, we would like to see your whatever you've written up there, and we'd like to vet it. And I said, I didn't know we were going to do that. Isn't that up against the First Amendment of the Constitution? Well, she was a nice old lady. She wore tennis shoes, I remember. She said, well, that's what I've been asked to do. So I sent this down to her. And about a month later, this is about when I'm winding up, she calls and said, we'd like you to come down and discuss this paper. And all the way down on the train, I was thinking, going through my mind, what am I going to do? If they say you've got to change this massively, I'm going to tell them you can stick it up here where the sun never shines. I'm not going to do that. You know, I had these mental arguments and fights, a wrestling match. When I got there, it was none of that at all, of course. She said, well, I see you say there are three things that that we have to question. One, you say that Admiral Dajian Lu, who was the man who came back to Vietnam after the World War II and got out of the airplane and said, we have come to reclaim our heritage. And I refer to him in this my book as one of the great Neanderthals of colonialism. And she said, don't you think that will make the French angry? I said, well, that's where I got it, was from the French. The second one was you say that the South Viet Cong foreign minister went to North Korea, and there was taken out to a Korean War memorial in which it was dedicated to the actions of Lieutenant Harrison, H-E-R-R-I-S-O-N, who committed a great number of atrocities during the Korean War. And she said, how do we know that Lieutenant Harrison committed these atrocities? I said, I don't. He probably didn't. It's just that they say he did. They built this monument like My Lai, early My Lai, and that's well, if you would put in there to say, they say that he did this, or he alleged or something. So I say, okay, I'll put that in. Then the third thing, what was it? Yeah, Lord Russell. You have a kind of negative statement about him being over the hill. You know, Lord Russell, as the famous British, Bertrand Russell, right? I forget, I had a kind of telling phrase in there, kind of one-liner about the guy, as he was running these war crimes trials in Stockholm. And I thought this was all horseshit, frankly, and I thought I'd just stick a little in. But, you know, he's a very great man. He's written marvelous materials, and she didn't say it, but she says, but, you know, you're very young, and I'm old, and he's old, and we older people don't like you young people saying these things about us. So I said, okay, I'll take out all the age references to it. So I'm waiting for it to get to the guts of the thing, which is that the whole thrust of Viet Cong is that the State Department and the government didn't know what they were doing in Vietnam because they didn't pay any attention to the other side. That runs all the way through it. It's said explicitly at the beginning. It's said at the end. So I'm thinking she would say, how do you handle this? Or, well, we don't like this. But instead she said, well, that's it. And I said, yeah, we're going to approve it. And of course, later on, people in the State Department said, you know, you really did us a lot of damage. You said that we didn't understand the Viet Cong, and that they weren't just lackeys from Hanoi, but they had a rationale of their own. And you said all that. And this was, you know, several years later in the war. And I said, well, that's what we all see now. Secretary of State says it now. Yeah, but you said it back then when it wasn't the party line. Thing about government, I don't know if you're thinking of going into it, Foreign Service is not what it used to be, but they got some great jobs. And the fact is that you're not inhibited really in writing if you're in government. Most people think you are, but you can really get away with murder in what you write. More so, there's less control on you and less censorship, personal, than there is, I think, in academia. Well, you got to be very careful in academia what you write. As a dissertation, depending on who your advisor is. I knew this girl at MIT who was writing a dissertation on windmills in English literature before the 13th century. And I said, well, that must be quite easy to do. It isn't too much. Yes, but the chairman of the department has also written on this. So I've got to be very careful. Whatever I write about this has to sort of square with what he, you know, there were two people in the whole world that cared what this thing said, but it was very important. Well, in government, it's not that way. In the State Department, what you learn very quickly is whatever you write, you do not criticize the military very directly or openly. Just as the military over in the Pentagon, in the policy jobs, are told you do not criticize the State Department. But anything else is going. So I was writing about the other side in Vietnam, and you know, they didn't have a defender in Washington. Nobody cared what I wrote about them. So I had a real gravy train ride all through the whole career in the Foreign Service. All right, anything else that you would like me to remember to touch on? Yeah.
One other thing is like the corruption, when you're talking about CIA, with all this
okay. Yeah. I get this kind of thing from students all the time, and I'm a little.
It's not a liberal.
No, it's not. No, it's not a liberal. It's. I mean, it's a kind of mindset that I call it the Jane Fonda syndrome. I was a couple of years ago at the Naval War College. Giving a lecture on Viet Cong strategy and tactics, the whole Dao Chan armed struggle, political struggle, maps, and then I said, are there any questions? First question, sir, what do you think of Jane Fonda? And I said, all right, I'll answer that, but first would you answer my question? Why did you ask that question? Well, we don't like her. We think she went to Vietnam and put her arms around this anti-aircraft gun that was shooting down Americans, and that's very bad. And I said, well, yeah, it is, but if you want a list of Americans who hurt us in the war, I could give you a list of 100 names, and she wouldn't even be on it. I mean, she really didn't do anything, and yet years later, here she is, still being vilified. She shows up in San Francisco to introduce her new swimsuit, or I guess it's clothing to wear when you're doing exercises. And there were 100 veterans out in front of Macy's protesting it. Macy's canceled it. And it's a phenomenon I don't understand. I mean, knowing a lot about Vietnam doesn't help you a bit. And I get calls from, I've had people come in to do things. I say, go over to the sociology department and ask them this question. Because knowing a lot about Vietnam does not explain the Jane Fonda syndrome. Also, this sort of mesmerization or infatuation with dirty tricks and the SOG missions and all the things that the assassination plots and the whole conspiracy thesis. It's not just students, it's Oliver Stone and the whole, there's a whole conspiracy crowd out there on the internet, and I get their stuff all the time. But what I don't understand is the mindset behind it. Now, I have concluded this is not a political science subject, and it's not a history subject. It is a social psychology. And the answers to it, to the jury, aren't really the truth of whether these things went on or not, but the phenomenon itself. But I admit it's very intriguing, this whole sarin. Are you familiar with the poison gas in Laos thing? The CNN and Time magazine had this blockbuster new program, and one of the things, they had Peter Arnett, and who was Pulitzer Prize winner from Vietnam, and a woman named Oliver, who's a CNN researcher, who the initial program, it was supposed to be a blockbuster program, and what it conveyed was that during the war, the Americans used sarin nerve gas, and they dropped it on a Pathet Lao camp 60 miles inside of Laos to kill Americans who were in the camp, and they were Americans believed to be to be defectors, deserters, and the horror of this. Now that means if this is true, and this was done during the Nixon administration, done by the CIA, not done by the Pentagon, they made that point. Of course, the Pentagon hit this. Everybody